Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There are two ways to think about the real estate market. The first way is that the buying and selling part is getting better, which it actually is. The second way is that the foreclosure part might actually be getting worse. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. $25 trillion of investment assets are accounted for with software from SunGard Financial Systems. More information at SunGard.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 9th of October. Glad to have you with us. There have been signs of life in the housing market for months now. New home sales ticking up, prices stabilizing. Yesterday, the Obama administration said it has reached its goal of modifying a 500,000 troubled mortgages ahead of schedule. That 500,000, though, is just a small slice of the entire number of homeowners at risk. And a report out today says that despite the gains in the housing market, what's being done isn't enough to protect millions of other Americans from foreclosure. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
The administration's Home Affordable Plan has helped 500,000 homeowners modify their mortgages and reduce their payments.
That is not a small number. The largest number of people that have been helped by any federal plan.
Still, Kevin Stein at the California Reinvestment Coalition is a critic. He says the plan was really set up to help folks in trouble with subprime loans. But
in our state, for example, we have over 12% unemployment and rising. And there really is nothing in place for families that have lost their jobs.
Even when home affordable is running at full strength,
foreclosures will be outrunning modifications by more than 2-to-1.
Elizabeth Warren heads the Congressional Oversight Panel. She says banks are still not processing mortgage modifications quickly enough. And a new wave of mortgage resets is looming.
It's September 2007 all over again.
Mark Hansen is a real estate consultant in the San Francisco Bay Area. He says hundreds of billions of dollars in large, interest-only adjustable rate mortgages are about to reset. These so-called option arms let home buyers pay only interest for the first 5 years. When buyers have to start paying the principal, there's often trouble.
These loans have the lowest cure rate and the highest loss severity of any of the loans. I mean, they're worse than subprime loans.
And many of these loans are concentrated in California and Florida, in some of the most expensive neighborhoods in the country. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
There has been some talk lately about whether General Electric is going to sell NBC Universal to Comcast, the big cable company. For that to happen, though, something else would need to get done first. The French entertainment firm Vivendi would have to sell its 20% stake in NBC back to General Electric. Then GE would sell a controlling interest to Comcast. Yes, I know that sounds like so much corporate gobbledygook, but Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains from New York that a Comcast-owned NBC would be quite noticeable to consumers.
For one thing, if Comcast runs NBC, it'll become the biggest media company in the country. Stephen Winokur is a research analyst at Sanford Bernstein. He says with Comcast, NBC would have an owner more concerned with content than corporate stock.
Clearly, you know, they're a pure play cable and media company, and they will approach things differently in a pure play basis than GE, which is looking at how is NBC going to help drive profitability for shareholders over time.
Winokur says under GE's management, NBC's cable channels have flourished as its broadcast and film businesses have lagged. Analyst Laura Martin at Soleil Securities says GE's frugality has been downright harmful to NBC.
They've been cutting back and doing stupid things like putting Leno in prime time, which has really destroyed a lot of value and angered a lot of advertisers because they're trying to save money.
If Comcast runs the show, Martin expects NBC will have better programming. And she thinks the ad-supported online TV site Hulu, partially owned by NBC, would start charging viewers. As for cutbacks, Stephen Winokur says he wouldn't expect much of that under Comcast.
With Comcast, there's less overlap than, say, if a Time Warner were to do a deal like this, where there'd be a lot more overlap and you could, I think, count on a lot more cost reduction.
But, of course, all this depends on Vivendi selling its NBC Universal stake back to GE. That won't happen until mid-November at the earliest. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Now that we've had more than a decade of getting used to free news on the web, Rupert Murdoch wants it to stop. Today, the owner of a company that's name literally is news went after what he calls content kleptomaniacs, otherwise known as search engines, bloggers, and social networking sites. The CEO of News Corp promised they will soon have to pay for, in his words, co-opting his property. The head of the Associated Press delivered a similar warning today at a big media conference in Beijing. Tom Curley said the wire service will be going after those who profit without paying for AP content. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more.
How's this for irony? I first found my way to this story, as did many others, through a link on Google's news page. Jeff Jarvis is the author of What Would Google Do? And he says news publishers need to learn from, not blame, sites like Google.
In the link economy, content that gets no links has no value. It gains value as it gets links. So if you put a news story up, you want there to be tweets to it with links and blog posts and aggregators links from Google News. And that brings value to you because it brings you audience. It's then up to you to exploit the value of that audience.
Both Murdoch's News Corp and the Associated Press have made deals with Google. Murdoch's Wall Street Journal may be a paid site, but Google is allowed to post links that bypass the paid gateway. Danny Sullivan watches the industry for the website Search Engine Land. He suggests Murdoch wants to have his cake and eat it too.
Not only does he want to get Google to send him traffic for free, but he'd also like to get paid even more money on top of all that.
Murdoch has been saying recently he plans to put his other publications behind similar paid content gateways. And at the Poynter Institute, media business analyst Rick Edmonds says some news executives are still convinced that might be their salvation.
Not so long ago, we thought all television was free. Well, that's kind of changed over time. So I think we're going to see a period of experimentation with different forms of paid content or trying to make that idea stick.
Critics warn that's like trying to put the free content genie back in the bottle, and they argue it's way too late for that. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
2 years ago today, the Dow hit its record high. We are not back there yet, but this Friday afternoon it closed at its high for the past 52 weeks. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You want to know what's happening in the economy, you got to get out there, sniff around, see what's actually being bought, sold, and processed where the rubber meets the road. Check the traffic to factories and warehouses and onto retail stores. See what's happening with freight trains, long-haul trucks, and car carriers. That's what Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has been up to today.
Shipments of everything from coal for power plants to lumber for construction sites to cars for dealer lots are down from a year ago. That's according to a report this week from the Association of American Railroads. Dan Keene is their economist.
Beginning in the fall, freight rail traffic basically fell off a cliff and has stayed down in double digits.
The good news, such as it is that freight trains have stopped getting shorter. Keene says rail companies are starting to take cars out of storage. And that's a sure sign they're getting more orders to move raw materials to factories and consumer goods to distribution warehouses. Chuck Cloudis follows the freight industry at IHS Global Insight.
And that pent-up demand, a portion of that's being released now. As the consumer starts buying and plants start putting people back to work, there are more trucks on the road, the trains are longer.
And the ships are coming in. At the port of Portland, there are more cars and shoes arriving from Asia, more wheat and minerals heading the other way. Port spokesman Josh Thomas says volume was up from July to August, but it's still down 15% to 60% from a year ago. And that hurts if your job depends on moving stuff.
There is a domino effect, not only here at the port, but with many private companies, shippers, logistics firms, the longshoremen.
Economists say this whole complex of ports, rail, and trucking will have to see sustained growth before many idled employees can get back to work. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
There is that natural human tendency to want to suppress painful memories. So once the wave of stories about the anniversary of the failure of Lehman Brothers and the beginning of a bailout economy were wrapped up, we sort of stopped hearing about the events of last fall. Until this week, here to explain and help analyze in our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond, are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Also, John Carney from ClusterStock.com is with us. Hello again, you guys.
Good to be here, Kai.
Thanks.
Travel back with me to last Monday and this report we got from the TARP Inspector General that said, in essence, Ben Bernanke and Henry Paulson were not entirely on the up and up with us last fall when they said the banks that they had given all these billions to were healthy. John, should we be upset that they weren't playing straight?
Yeah, I think we should be very upset. For whatever reasons that they want to give, that it was okay to lie to the public to ward off a panic, that's not really the way democracy is supposed to work.
Lee, what did Henry Paulson know and when did he know it, right?
Well, that's a really good question, and it makes us travel not just back to Monday, but back, you know, a year ago when everything was going crazy. But if this is all true, they were basically making a judgment call that, the truth might be more dangerous, that it might inspire some kind of panic. But really, it just speaks to the degree to which everything was just really more opaque than maybe we even thought.
Well, yeah, but on the theory that context is everything, Lee, let's remember where we were last September, right? I mean, there were actual conversations about financial apocalypse happening.
That's true. And, you know, don't forget they were trying to sell this enormous bailout plan. And many critics back then were saying that, you know, these banks might not need the money.
John, what does it mean for whether or not we can believe what we're hearing now about things like the stress test the Obama administration did and the health of the banks now?
I think it severely has undermined the credibility of our financial regulators. We need to be able to trust these people to be straight with us. Everything they say, we now have to wonder, you know, wait, do they have a motive for lying in this case?
John, I just want to double check with you here. Lie is a pretty strong word. You going to stick with that?
Yeah, I think that they straight out lied to us.
On the topic of the big banks and the Treasury Secretary, let's go to the current occupant of the office, Timothy Geithner. That story that came out this week about his phone records and the disproportionate amount of time he's spending on the phone with three CEOs of big Wall Street banks and not talking to congressmen and too many other people out there. Lee, what do you think?
In his role, he does need to be in touch with Wall Street. What the story pointed out was that there was a really exclusive group of people that he was in touch with far more frequency than anybody else.
John?
I think what's really fascinating is that the CEO of J.P. Morgan and the CEO of Goldman spend so much time talking to the Treasury Secretary. So what we're seeing actually is which banks want to be closer to government.
But the whole tempest in a teapot argument that you're seeing out there a little bit, this whole, you know, Geithner's got to be talking to Wall Street, so leave him alone and let him make his phone calls, John.
J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs were two of the more successful banks that navigated through the crisis. So he may think that, it, you know, those are the guys you want to talk to. But they're also obviously self-interested. And so to not talk to their rivals seems at least a little off-putting.
Enough of the who did what to whom conversation. And let me move on to something I haven't done with you two in a little while, which is get all kumbaya on you here and ask you how you're feeling.
In terms of the economy...
Well, that's what I was talking about, because obviously I care about you as a person. But, you know.
I know. And I'm feeling great. But in terms of the economy, you know, I think, you know, things are turning around. We're seeing some good signs. I think the job situation continues to be an enormous tragedy at this point. I mean, it's really what makes this recession different than any other, and it's what will continue to be a problem for the foreseeable future.
John, I love you too, man. How are you feeling?
I think one of the things we've learned is that everybody was wrong. Nobody expected the stock market to perform the way it was. The stock market is booming. I don't see an end in sight for it right now.
Yes, but a stock market recovery does not an economic recovery make.
That is definitely true. I think there's no easy way out of the unemployment situation. There's entire segments of the economy where people spent years training themselves to work in parts that are no longer viable. It means we're stuck with a systematic unemployment for quite a while.
John Carney from ClusterStock.com, Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, an unusual product just for men.
I'll spend a lot of hours looking, you know, looking around to see what's hot and what's not. And but to be honest, mainly to be looking for what's not there.
But first, Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials put on 0.8% today, 78 points, closed at 9,864. The NASDAQ bulked up 0.7%, 15 points, 2139 at the bell. The S&P 500 rose 0.5%. That is 6 points. It rounded out the day and the week at 1,071. The markets were on a roll this week. The Dow packed on 4%. The NASDAQ and the S&P both shot up 4.5% since Monday. Financial firms took it to the bank today. J.P. Morgan Chase collected nearly 1.25%. Bank of America deposited around 1%. Goldman Sachs ticked up more than 0.5% today. We told you earlier about GE and NBC Universal and Vivendi. The news dimmed GE's shares today by 0.25 percentage point. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.39%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link. Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Stockholm, the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences is announced. In Rome, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization holds a two-day forum to discuss how to feed the world in 2050. And bond markets close for Columbus Day. Though the New York Stock Exchange closed for the occasion every year from 1909 to 1953, it doesn't anymore. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Matthew Pryor has a wife, two young sons, and a beautiful old house. He quit his job as a newspaper reporter to start an online business site. That went bust, so he got his old job back until he got laid off. He's upside down on his house, and he thinks his wife is having an affair. He could be your neighbor, but he is actually the protagonist of Jess Walter's new novel. It's called The Financial Lives of the Poets. Jess, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
This is an amazingly topical book. I mean, some of this stuff could be ripped from the headlines. But the thing is, I thought books took like years to write.
I think they tend to. But in that time, I think there's only 3 or 4 months of actual productive work. So I just tried to cut out all the self-loathing and just write it as quickly as possible once I realized what I had.
You just got right to it?
It just felt as if all of a sudden there was this economic crisis that wasn't the thing I was seeing on CNBC, some theoretical abstract thing, but a real thing that was affecting, you know, people around me. And it just felt like the opportunity to really take something and write it in a voice that I could do in a much quicker time.
He, that is your character, Matt Pryor, he makes some amazingly bad decisions. But I think part of that comes from the fact that he was caught just so unaware of what was happening in the economy.
It's easy to sort of blame the banks or blame this system that's broken. But the truth is, we spent years sort of going deep into debt and borrowing against things. None of us was raised this way. And so I think I wanted him to be both culpable and a sort of victim of these much larger forces that he has no idea about. And you wonder, can you wake up and just have everything collapse? And I think, you know, we all sort of did.
Like a lot of people, Matt and his wife bought a big house in a sort of an up-and-coming neighborhood. They watched it increase in value. They took money out, as so many people did. And you write a great paragraph about that house, their relationship with it, and what it really means. I'm wondering if you could pull up that page and give it a read.
We became like derivative-crazed brokers. We stopped thinking of the value of our home as a place of shelter and occupancy and family, or even as the aesthetic triumph witnessed from our alley, but as a kind of faith equation, theoretical construct, mechanism of wealth generation, salvation function on a calculator, its value no longer what it's worth, but some compounded value that might exist given the continued upward tick of the market, because this was the only direction housing markets could ever go up. All the geniuses said so.
Matt Pryor is a newspaper reporter. By the time of this book, he's a former newspaper reporter, has quit to start what seems to him to be a brilliant idea, this thing called Poet Folio. You got to help us understand that one.
I wanted Matt to be a newspaper reporter. I come from newspapers. I remember when all my friends were leaving to start websites, you know, that made no sense. You know, what size shoes do you wear.com. And I wanted him to have something like that. So I made him a poet in college. And so he decides that he's going to blend his two areas of knowledge. He's a financial business reporter. And so he's going to have a website, poetfolio.com, that blends business news and financial advice in poetry form.
Just for the record, I'm pretty sure Marketplace got a poetry grant at one point. So, you know, the two have been married before.
And that's where he gets his funding, is from the Poetry Foundation.
Do me a favor and read us one, would you?
M-tronic reports strong Q3. Higher than expected orders and a reversal of its earnings direction have led to an upward adjustment of M-tronic's third quarter projection and revived hopes for a sector move despite several analysts' rejection.
Shakespeare, it's not, but, you know, it's got a certain something to it.
The real freedom was making Matt a bad poet so that I didn't have to try to write above my ability.
Without giving away the ending, Matt, he wins a little, he loses a little by the end of this thing. What do you want people to be thinking about as they turn that last page?
Toward the end of the novel, I kept thinking, if all that happens is that our 401ks go back up, that everything turns out the same. And, you know, I grew up, my father worked at an aluminum plant that closed as we were kids. And we grew up without money, and we survived it just fine. There are more important things, and that's, I think, the realization I wanted Matt to come to. For him, the story has been about his family. And I think, you know, if there's any lesson in the book, though God help me if there's a lesson ever in my work, but if there is, then it might be that.
Well, Jess, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you, Kai.
The most recent book by Jess Walter is called The Financial Lives of the Poets. We've got the first chapter of it on our website. It's marketplace.org. Across the broad spectrum of consumer marketing in this country, things tend to break down fairly predictably. I generalize here a little bit, but products for women are usually sold in a feminine way. Kid stuff is playful and exciting. For men, it's generally things only a real man would want, like candles. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk, Caitlin Carroll reports.
Candles don't sound like something a tough guy would want. But what about mandals?
Don't know what to get the man who is admired for his manliness by other manly men? Never fear. The Chuck Norris sweat mandal is here.
I have no idea where that came from.
It came from YouTube. It's a spoof on mandals. Jennifer Catron and her husband Mark started the candle company a few months ago. It's not their first venture.
Been through so many.
Yeah, I spent a lot of hours looking around to see what's hot and what's not, and but to be honest, mainly to be looking for what's not there.
What's not there? Candles designed for men, with special manly smells like dirt and rawhide. To see if this is something a guy would actually buy, I head out to Big Wang's Sports Bar in Hollywood. I find Brad Caracciolo drinking beer and watching football.
I buy candles for my room.
What kind?
What did I get last time? Mango.
It seems promising. So I take out the mandal and light it up. It's bacon scented.
This smells like the sponge in a urinal.
There are others, like Bass Killer, Auto Shop, Meat and Potatoes. Caracciolo shakes his head.
I buy my candles so it smells good for girls, not for me.
His buddy, Gerard Palacios, says this is definitely something a guy would not buy for himself.
It's the type of product a girlfriend would buy for you, and then you'd break up the next week, but you'd have a mandal at the end of the relationship. So it's a win-win-win, you know?
And there's the rub. The candles are for men, but about 90% of all candles, almost $2 billion worth, are bought by women. So how do you sell a $15 candle that smells, well, kind of gross? Play up the novelty factor. Joe Priester is a marketing professor at the University of Southern California.
I think it can get people who sort of buy it because it's sort of ironic and hip, and I think still tap into people that are really buying it from a more non-ironic position.
That can work, says Joseph Pedot, godfather of the novelty business. He's behind
Chia.
Chia Pets.
And
Clap On, Clap Off.
The Clapper. PDOT says to make a mark in the novelty business, products have to be fun, cheap to sell, but even cheaper to make.
And there, that's like finding a needle in a haystack. It really is. If you get one, then it's worth it.
The Catrons think they may have one. They've made a couple thousand dollars on mandals in the first few months of business, and they're expanding the line.
A couple of upcoming smells we're going to have is burnt gunpowder, which is like in pretty high demand. We've received lots of requests.
And I'd then, like to do wet dog, but I haven't figured out how exactly you put wet dog into a machine.
What they really need is to figure out how to turn stink into the sweet smell of profits. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note this Friday afternoon, enough of the real news. Time for the tidbits that didn't make the headlines, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Noonan, and select members of the Marketplace staff.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Australia is trying to limit drinking.
Impossible.
Well, limit might be kind of a strong term. Fans of this really popular car race in Australia called the Bathurst 1000 are going to be limited to a slab of beer a day, which is 24 beers.
24 beers per person. That's a limit.
Yeah, they're trying to reduce crime. As if after 24 beers you could even commit a crime.
Exactly. It's going to work.
Millie Jefferson, production assistant at Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Apparently, a university in Liverpool is now offering a master's degree in Beatles music.
What?
And now I'm starting to rethink the master's degree that I actually did.
You worked 8 days a week for what?
Exactly.
Well, now I know how to follow up my Metallica GED.
George Judson, managing editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Business suits that protect you against swine flu.
Tell me more.
Well, it's a Japanese invention.
Of course.
They're producing suits that are coated with a chemical that is usually found in toothpaste that will kill the virus.
See, I've got a simpler swine flu suit. It's a neon lime green, and whenever I wear it, people just stay far away from me.
That is just a taste of what Rico and Brendan have to offer. Their podcast is called The Dinner Party Download. There is a link to it on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 78 points, 0.8%. The NASDAQ up 15 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 up 6 points, 0.5%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yule. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, kids and their own financial lives.
I saved, I spent.
Sounds kind of grown up to me. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back here Monday afternoon. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.